All right, a couple of announcements just to remind you. The week of the 25th, 26th, and 27th, there will be no Bible class in September. In November, Thanksgiving week, Wednesday and Thursday, there will be no class. We'll have class Tuesday. And then if people are traveling Wednesday, they don't have to worry about that. And then 25th, 26th, 27th of December, there will be no class that week. So even if you party on the 31st and get horribly drunk, you should be sober by the Tuesday night on the 1st. And you can get most of your football out of the way. And if you can't, that's why God made DVRs. We know why. All right, well, let's make sure you're in fellowship in case something bad happened to you on break, like somebody stepped on your toe, spiritually or physically. Let's continue on here. We're dealing here in verse 44. I will make what Baal has swallowed come out of his mouth, and the nations will no longer stream to him. Again, this is one of those verses I believe you have to look at in terms of dual fulfillments. This was true of ancient Babylon. Now, it didn't happen quickly, but obviously as the Medo-Persians took over and Babylon ceased, not completely ceased, but certainly became less important, and people weren't as anxious to get there as they might have been previously. And people were wanting to be, you know, in the new hotspot. You know how people are. If it's cool, I got to be there. So if what's cool changes, well, I'll change tomorrow with it. And that's not a good way to approach life, by the way. But that's, unfortunately, that's generally the human race. So this occurred certainly historically when Babylon began its decline. But prophetically, it's broadened to include a bunch of nations. And so, point 19 is where we're ready to resume here. The history of immigration in prophetic Babylon is easily documented. This land has been a land of immigrants even before it actually became a nation. By the 1500s, the first Europeans, led by the Spanish and French, had begun establishing settlements. That fear that they would fall off the edge of the world never materialized. They managed to make it over here. And obviously, of course, as you know, the oldest settlement is a Spanish one up there in around Jacksonville. What was the name of that place? St. Augustine. Yeah, I've been there. It's very memorable. No, I'm kidding. It was a nice. It was weird, but it's a tourist trap now. I mean, you know, mostly it's haunted tours and haunted jails and ghosts and all of that. But you know, that Spanish fort there was pretty cool. I did enjoy that So the way they handled evangelism, you had to love the Spanish, and they were largely Catholic, and so you had an opportunity that they would take you down there by the seashore, and if you did not convert to Catholicism, they'd shoot you and throw you in the bay, and that was it. And that's how they handled evangelism. So that settlement was old, obviously, and they'd begun establishing settlements in what would become the U.S. In 1607, the English founded their first permanent settlement at Jamestown. In the Virginia colony. And see, some of America's first settlers came in search of religious freedom. In 1620, a group of roughly 100 people, later known as the Pilgrims, fled religious persecution in Europe and arrived at present-day Plymouth, Massachusetts. And they were soon followed by a larger group seeking religious freedom, the Puritans, who established the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And again, whether you have to agree or disagree with Puritan theology, it tended to be a little extreme, I get that. But the reality was the principle of religious freedom that drove these people is a good thing. Even if their theology isn't perfect or even good in some cases. The concept of being able to worship God freely apart from the Pope and the throne was very important to these people. But of course, as you know, in England, the church had essentially been seized by the king, and they established the old C of E, the Church of England, and had some minor break, but still, it was basically still just Catholic doctrine and dogma. just taught in a different form in some ways, or with a new, quote, head of the church. Now the king is the head of the church. So by some estimates, 20,000 Puritans migrated to the region between 1630 and 1640. However, of course, not all immigration was voluntary. Many slaves were brought here against their will during the colonial period, but Congress outlawed the importation of slaves to the U.S. in 1808. And then, gee, another major wave of immigration. But some of that, you know, the slave trade and all was actually fought against by other people that weren't here. If you're not familiar with it, look up a guy named Wilberforce and read his story. It's an interesting one. If you are, then you already know what it's about. But people were fighting this. It wasn't as though the U.S. was the only one that didn't think this was moral or good, necessarily. So another major wave of immigration occurred from about 1815 to 1865. The majority of these newcomers hailed from Northern and Western Europe. And approximately one-third came from Ireland, which experienced a massive famine in the mid-19th century. And in the 1840s, almost half of America's immigrants were from Ireland alone. And in the 19th century, the United States received some 5 million German immigrants. I'm assuming I must be from one of those with a name, Snyder. I'm presuming it's German. But I've never bothered looking at it because I don't care. It doesn't affect me. I'm not agonizing over my ancestry. But what if you got somebody great in your family tree? How does that help me? What does it do for me? What if it's just a bunch of nut jobs in my family tree? And I don't want a nut. And that is far more likely than you got somebody famous. And even if they were famous, what does that help you? You're not famous just because you're related to them. Oh, I'm a great-great-great-great-granddaughter of Adam. Oh, well, he's famous, all right. He wrecked the human race. He's known for that. So I'm always puzzled by people that think they're impressive because they have somebody famous in their family tree. As we know, you shake most family trees and nothing falls out but nuts. That's just the way it is. Like a pecan tree. Another major wave came then. Approximately a third came from Ireland, which had experienced this famine. And then in Jay here during the mid-1800s, a significant number of Asian immigrants settled in the U.S. The news of the California Gold Rush brought some 25,000 Chinese to the country. And Kay, between 1820 and 1920, during a time of rapid industrialization and urbanization, America received more than 20 million immigrants. That's in a period of about 40 years. Now, that's a lot by anybody's standards, I would think. Beginning in the 1890s, the majority of the arrivals were from Central, Eastern, and Southern Europe. And in that decade alone, some 600,000 Italians migrated to America. And by 1920, more than 4 million had entered the United States. Jews from Eastern Europe fleeing religious persecution also arrived in large numbers. Over 2 million entered the U.S. between 1880 and 1920. So to say that we're a melting pot is really almost an understatement. I mean, it really almost doesn't do justice to the number of cultures and things that have moved here. Willingly, too. They weren't, obviously, some, I say willingly, they chose to. Many of them were fleeing persecution, famine, difficulties, oppressive regimes, all of this. And that's a reason to want to get out. But, again, a true melting pot when you consider that people all over the world decided here was the place to be. For much of the 20th century, the federal government had left immigration policy to individual states. However, by the final decade of the century, the government decided it needed to step in to handle the ever-increasing influx of newcomers. And in 1890, President Harrison designated Ellis Island as a federal immigration station. More than 12 million immigrants entered the U.S. through Ellis Island during its years of operation. From 1892... to the year of my birth, 1954. So, the peak year for admission of new immigrants was 1907, when approximately 1.3 million people entered the country legally. And that does not, by the way, do recognize, as you probably already do if you're thinking about it, that none of that, all those numbers don't include illegal immigration. There may have been illegal immigration going on side by side with all of this. But not everybody felt like they had to be under the law. So although immigration has been curbed by you government regulations and anti-immigrant sentiment, well, after a point, though, your nation becomes anti-immigrant. I think it's just a factor of the way the world works. I don't know about you. I personally get tired of hearing people speaking in other languages that aren't English. It's tiresome to me. If you want to come here, that's fine. If you want to live here, I'm not against you. We're told in the Bible to be kind to the strangers and the immigrants and all of that. But you need to assimilate. We don't need to assimilate to you. We're not going to learn Spanish. This brainwashing has been going on since I was a child. They were forced us in elementary school to sit there and take an hour of Spanish every day. We would sit there and watch Channel 13, OETA, for those of you who were in the school system back there. And I thought to myself, even then, and like I was in third or fourth grade, I thought, why are we doing this? Why do I need to learn this language? And what's the point of all of this? And again, it's not a bad thing to know another language. In fact, one of the things I saw the other day, that people who learn, that there's a real benefit in learning and knowing other languages, at least a second one. That there are some mental benefits to it. They suggest it might even be healthy and stave off things like Alzheimer's and this kind of stuff. That the more you use your brain, obviously, the better off you are. But there's a song, I remember this guy named Randy Stonehill, and he said, just put your brain in neutral and turn on the television set. Kick off your shoes and don't worry, they haven't cut the power off yet. And that's sadly where most Babylonians end up. Putting their brains in neutral and leaving them there. You have to think and think rigorously. And this is part of what doctrine is all about. It's to teach you how to think. Not only the principles of what is true, but how to think logically, how to arrive at the truth. God doesn't do things haphazardly. He tells us to be diligent, to do things decently in an orderly fashion. Well, do you think it's because He doesn't? God is an orderly God. Again, anti-immigrant settlement comes up after a point, though. And I understand this. I'm not anti-immigrant. I'm anti-illegal immigration. I'm anti that. But every citizen should be anti that. But the delusionary people in this country, they're not. They think illegal immigration's fine. They tend to be liberals and Democrats. I get it. But the fact is, you know, after a point, you're not doing your nation any favors. Obviously, there's always going to be a certain amount of legal immigration allowed, as I think there probably should be. But again, the politics of all of it, we're not here to argue about. It's just to point out that this is just the way it is. So the majority of U.S. immigrants now come from Asia and Latin America rather than Europe. The verb translated as stream here is only used three times in the Old Testament. And the other two passages indicate that the nations and peoples of the world will stream to the millennial kingdom. Isaiah. And in fact, I am certain that these verses are in some way form the backdrop to what we're studying here, because this is the opposite of that. Isaiah 2:2. And it will come about in the last days. And certainly Jeremiah would have been familiar with this writing. Isaiah wrote probably at least 70 years before him, if not more. And the mountain of the house of the Lord will be raised. The mountain is a symbol in prophetic language for the kingdom. So you can translate this, the kingdom of the house of the Lord will be established as the chief of the kingdoms. And it will be raised above the hills, and all the nations will stream to it. And many peoples will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us concerning his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For the law will go forth from Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And the second one there, Micah 4:1, and I believe that's almost, if not a word for word, I think it's pretty close, if not a word for word quote. And it will come about in the last days that the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as the chief of the kingdoms. It will be raised above the hills. The hills, again, represent lesser kingdoms. Things not as powerful. If the U.S. is a mountain, Guatemala is probably a hill. Just to pick one. There are other ones. And the peoples will stream to it, and they will say, come and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord and the house of the God of Jacob again, so he can teach us. The positive volition will begin to manifest itself during the millennial reign. So, 21, the final statement of verse 44 deals with the matter of Babylon's fortifications and defensive capabilities. Babylon's huge walls were symbols of its supposedly unassailable strength. Although ancient authors exaggerated the size of the walls, it is agreed that they were massive. We don't know how high. Some of them had, I think it was Herodotus, if I remember, he had the walls being 300 feet high. Unlikely. But, I mean, really, if you've got a 60 or 70 foot wall, that's huge during that period in history. And it's pretty well agreed that Herodotus probably exaggerated this or was given false information and bought into it. They exaggerate. It's agreed, again, they were massive. There were two walls. Some even suggest that Babylon had three walls. The outer one was 12 feet thick, and the inner one was 21 feet thick, enclosing an area of approximately 3 square miles. That was just their capital. And again, at that time in history, that's huge. That's very big. Well, 22, these impressive fortifications around the city, should be around the city, represented the nation's best efforts to guarantee her security and protect her prestige. Once a wall of the city was breached, the city was often helpless before its attackers. That was the beginning of the end if the wall was breached. And this should be understood here in terms of modern defensive capabilities that do not rely on fortified walls, towers, gates, and bars. Rather, it refers to the defensive military capabilities that are designed to protect the nation from attack. And as we know, sadly, we've been letting our facilities and our capabilities flounder for a number of years. And we've got to spend money on many other things. We shouldn't worry about defense. We'll be safe. God will protect us. He wouldn't let anything happen to America. He wouldn't? Okay, let's wait and see. So 24, the statement here uses a Hebrew perfect, has fallen. That's there at the end of verse 44. The broad wall there of Babylon here has fallen. Even the wall has fallen down. And then another place I think is called the broad wall. 45, so every defensive capability, the idea of it is it will be neutralized or destroyed. And given what I know, again, of the modern complexities of this or simplicities of it, that you don't even really have to destroy our defensive capabilities. All you have to do is make sure they don't have time to use them. So that's easily done if you only got 33 minutes. And actually, again, far less than that, it'll be a period of like 6 to 8 minutes the government will have to respond. And they won't. This is what Americans fail to see. You think your government's going to protect you. They're not. We're not going to be here, fortunately. But the average person better learn they're not going to protect you. But as we were discussing on break, by the time all this comes down, the complexion of the nation has really changed, if you think about it. All believers have been taken out at the rapture. Then you only have a period of about another 3 years for people to convert. Well, I believe there will be converts during that time. And the smart ones will get out. And again, under the charge being led by the Jews. The Jews are going to be the ringleaders in all of this. So verse 45 here then now returns to the time prior to the destruction. Because the command to come forth would be foolish to be issued after. It's got to be a warning ahead of time. And reiterates a familiar theme throughout this prophecy. The call to flee logically stems from what has been said in the previous verse. It should be noted, too, point 26, that the freedom that the Jews have to exit Babylon cannot be applied to any historical situation of Jewish captivity. The Jews were held fast by the ancient kingdoms of Egypt, Assyria, and Babylon. That was referenced in our previous chapter, that just as these men had acted in a certain way and taken God's people. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the sons of Israel are oppressed, and the sons of Judah as well, and all who took them captive have held them fast. They have refused to let them go. And again, Babylon never did, of their own free will, let the Jews go. So that can't be applied historically, as it were. So however, the situation in prophetic Babylon is one in which the Jews are not being held against their will. Rather, it is a situation from which they are free to simply leave. They have a choice here. Obviously, under the Babylonian captivity, you can just leave whenever you felt like it. That would not have worked very well. So the reality that the Jews and anyone else living in Babylon are to exit Babylon and return to the land of their heritage has been seen repeatedly. We're not going to look these up. We've seen all these. Isaiah 13, 14, 47, 15, Jeremiah 54 and 5, 8, 28, 51, 6, and 9. And, of course, our verse here, 45. So the Hebrew phrase translated of each of you is literally a man, his soul, or life, which stresses the individual responsibility of each person to act in his own best interest in order to ensure his survival. And again, you may be, let's assume one of us were alive here, we won't be, but let's say you were. Well, you would know what to do. You would have insight into this, and you would know that it's time to flee, and you would probably counsel people to do so. But the reality is there's going to be, none of us will be here. There will be other people counseling them to get out, however. But this is another issue, like in the Christian life. I may have some sense of what's in the best interest of a believer, but I can't live their Christian life for them. I can't make them do it. And if they won't do it of their own volition, we're not here to manipulate that. God doesn't manipulate volition. The goal of our instruction is love from a pure heart. You have to offer it and bring it because you want to. You have to apply because it comes from your soul. And obviously, if it's going to be rewardable, there are other factors. You've got to be in fellowship. We know that. And you got to have the right motive. You can't be doing it so people will be proud of you or impressed with you. Those motivations have to be correct. Well, there are a number of factors that go into it. And it has to be God's will. You can't just pull it out and say, well, I'm doing this and it's God's will because I say it is. You can't. That's not it either. You have to be in obedience to these things. Well, 30, the latter part of the verse also reiterates the reality that all that is coming upon Babylon is the expression of God's wrath against the nation, its people, and its practices. Isaiah 13, 5 and 13, Jeremiah 50, 13 and 25. And again, as a believer, I have mixed feelings. You sympathize. I looked at that hurricane bearing down on the coast. I felt sorry for those people. There's nothing wrong with having compassion and empathy. Now, I can't go up there and change it. Wouldn't try. Only a fool would drive into the middle of a hurricane. But and no doubt people have done it. There have been fools, trust me. But I sympathize with it. But on the other hand, I read the Bible and I think, God's not doing this arbitrarily or he's not doing it quickly. This has been brewing for years, decades, and centuries maybe even. And it's due and it's deserved. Again, if he doesn't judge Babylon pretty soon, he's going to have to apologize to all these other kingdoms that he's judged. Because we're as bad as them. And again, we live, in the time of history when it was prophesied it was going to be horrible. We know that. In the last days, perilous, dangerous, times will come. Why? Because it's all about me, 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 me. Men will be lovers of self. Lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. How do we determine how we love ourselves or we love God? Priorities. What are the spiritual Christian priorities of the Christian way of life? Figure them out. Execute them. Yeah, but I got stuff that, I got more important stuff to do. My priorities are bigger. Well, they're really not. You're losing out with that attitude if you haven't. They're not. Your priorities, my priorities, God's priorities take precedence, or they're supposed to. All right, well now verse 46, let's move on here. Let me just close this out because I know we're going to need more sheets. Now beware, lest your heart will not grow faint. And beware, lest you fear the report that will be heard in the land. Beware is actually all you have here is a conjunction wow that's translated as now, which of course is just a W. And then the conjunction pen, P-E-N. This word means so that, not, or lest. And the idea here is because this is a command, although it's expressed in an imperfect. And sometimes commands could be expressed by imperfects. In fact, that's the normal way you would find a command, or more often prohibitions, in the Hebrew. You will do thus and such, or you will not do thus and such. So the imperfect here of ra-kak. R-A-K-H-A-K. Eight times, this word means actually to be tender, weak, or soft. When it's used of the heart or the mind, it means to be timid or fearful. So beware that not be fearful, masculine, singular noun, construct, levav. L-E-B-H-A-B-H. This is the Hebrew word for heart, sometimes shortened to lave, but levav is the longer form. The heart of you all, a masculine plural suffix. He's addressing all these people, but as individuals, you all. So lest, beware, look out, lest your heart will not grow faint. That is our first part. And beware, lest you fear the report. Again, while the first part here, the pen, is not repeated, it's still part of this warning. You got a wow plus the cal imperfect of yare, y-a-r-e apostrophe. That word means exactly that, to fear or to be afraid. And then the inseparable preposition bait follows it, which introduces the object of fear. Beware lest you fear the report. The definite article here, with the term shamua. This comes from the verb shama, to hear, S-H-E-M-U-A-H. Shemua means what is being heard, a report. It's like a passive participle in form. A report, a news, or even a rumor, sometimes this word is translated. Because all reports aren't accurate. People say things that aren't true, as you might know. Beware lest you fear the report that will be heard in the land. The report, and then you have the definite article, the one being heard, that will be heard in the land. The definite article with the nifal participle, the one being heard, because this is going to be an ongoing thing, apparently. This would indicate shama, as that's the verb, the verbal root of that previous noun, in fact. That modifies the term report, the one being heard. So the participle would tend to emphasize ongoing action. Once the 144,000 Jews, how many ever of them may end up here or be here in this country, and they begin to gap this information and they get it. And God the Holy Spirit's going to be working overtime, no doubt, with these people. As we have seen, Jewish positive volition. And why did God ever pick that nation out of all the nations? Because of its positive volition that he saw throughout the history of this nation. Beginning back with Abraham before it was even a nation. Continuing through the patriarchs, Isaac, Jacob, on through Moses, up to getting them into the land and all that. And then, of course, once there, they formally become a nation. And then the kinds of volition that existed in there. Even though many of them, you look at the Hall of Fame, as it's talked about in Hebrews 11. The believers that are talked about, they're all Jewish. Every one of them. And for good reason. In the history of that nation, there's been a lot of quality positive volition. I don't mean people that just got saved. David was a quality believer. Solomon was. Didn't mean he didn't go through his periods and all that. Saul started out good. Unfortunately, ended up a reversionist and God killed him. But, and you look at the people that come through there, up through in the time of Christ. Obviously, salvation is of the Jews. Jesus was Jewish. He wasn't black. He wasn't African. He wasn't all this other stuff people want to make him. He was Jewish. And then, of course, the volition you see among the Jews, even there, the early disciples. And you want to be even-handed with these men. And you see them in the gospel and they're portrayed as bumbling idiots almost. And in many ways, they were spiritually bumbling idiots. But then you see what happens after the resurrection and it's like, well, they're different men. Here one minute they're hiding for their lives like weak women locking the door, and then the next minute they're out taking on the temple authorities. and all of that, being beat for their faith, and when they ran away, the second danger presented at any other time. So they were transformed, and that's one of the things that speaks to the resurrection. That is one of the subtle proofs that people don't think about. What proves the resurrection? Look at the change in those men. Tell me why. Give me one reason why they went from bumbling idiots and cowards, in some ways, to men who were willing to take on the Roman Empire. What changed? And the only answer you can really give in a big way is the resurrection. They knew they didn't have to fear death. They knew that God was on their side. So, you look at that nation and all the people that have come through there. So, again, once these 144,000 crank up and get going, there's no doubt to me God's going to bless them and bless their message. And it'll be heard. I think God gives everybody a chance to get out. He's fair about this. So, beware lest you hear the report that will be heard in the land. For the report, in the land is inseparable preposition bait here plus the definite article plus eretz, land or nation. Nation here would be fine as well, too. That it's going to be heard in that nation specifically. The U.S. For the report will come in 1 year. And after that, the same report in the next year. And violence will be in the land with ruler against ruler. The report will come is actually our verb first. It's the cal perfect of bo, the wow consecutive with a cal perfect of bo. That word means exactly that's a simple verb to come. Will come in the year. In the year. Here the definite article functions as the number one almost. In the year. In the year, the first year or 1 year. Either way, how you want to render this is fine. The definite article with the word shana. S-H-A-N-A apostrophe. H. I'm sorry, that's an H. Shana. In the year, in 1 year, and after that, the same report in the next year. And then you have the definite article, the report, with the adverb, the wow, and after that is the adverb akhar, A-C-H-A-R. That means after or behind. Sometimes it's used spatially. Of time, it means after. And after him or it, the third masculine singular suffix, and after him that, and after him would be the year, not the report. The report is feminine in the Hebrew. The word year is, well, I'm sorry, take that back. It's feminine as well. He will come, it's probably modifying the third masculine singular on the verb bo there. And after him that, in the year, in other words, after that first year, in the next year. So they've smoothed all this out to say, after that, the same report the next year. And then you have the definite article. The definite article is used here to keep identifying that same report. The article's telling you I'm referring to this same thing throughout this section here. That same report in the next year is the way they've translated all this. It's a little more convoluted in the Hebrew. And then you follow the definite article, the report. And violence will be in the land with ruler against ruler. And is the wow here, connective, plus the word kamas, C-H-A-M-A-S. Oppression, violence, injustice in the land or in the nation. Inseparable preposition bait plus the definite article plus eretz again, the land or nation. And ruler with ruler against ruler. The wow here with the calactive participle of mashal, M-A-S-H-A-L. Again, the calactive participle here functioning as a substantive, one ruling, one having power or dominion, so you just translate it like a noun, ruler, against ruler. Calactive participle of mashal, again, against is a al. We've seen this frequently used in this way throughout this prophecy. Therefore, behold, days are coming when I will punish the idols of Babylon. And her whole land will be put to shame. And all her fatally wounded will fall in her midst. Therefore, behold, you got this inseparable preposition lamed with the adverb kain, actually, K-E-N. Literally, for this reason, or therefore, behold, conjunction, interjection here, hene, a look, behold, pay attention. Days, masculine plural noun of yom, are coming. Calactic participle of the simple verb to come, we've seen both. Days are coming when I will punish the idols of Babylon. Again, pakad, we've seen this verb a number of times. The emphasis a lot of times is on the punishment aspect. But it is used in other ways. I will punish the idols of Babylon. Here, the preposition al again introduces the objects of what he's going to punish. Or you can translate, I will bring punishment against. Communicates the same thing. The idols of Babylon. Idols are pasil, P-A-S-I-Y-L, used 23 times. Literally what has been carved from stone, sometimes wood. The idols of Babylon, these are the ones they worship. These are their gods. Of Babel. Her whole land. All of her land, literally. Feminine singular noun again of Eretz, with the masculine noun kol, all, each, or every. Here, singular, all of her land. Feminine singular noun with the third suffix, Eretz. Her nation will be put to shame or disgraced. Cal, here, imperfect of Bosh. B-O-S-H. And again, while disgrace and shame are generally considered to be emotional responses and all of that, in the ancient realm, the matter of shame was a public thing. It was how you were perceived publicly, what people could see. And it dealt not so much with how you felt about it as the fact that people looked down on you. They treated you in a shameful way because you were viewed as being shameful. So the whole land will be put to shame. And her fatally wounded will fall in her midst. And then all of, again, the masculine singular noun, you got a wow, and the masculine noun of kol, all, each, or every, depend on here. All of, then the masculine plural noun, construct, and since this is a plural, we would translate it all of rather than each one. All of her, this word, kalal, C-H-A-L-A-L, can mean either mortally wounded or dying or dead. It depends on where you're at in the process. You may have just been shot, but you're going to die slowly. Well, then at that point, you're just mortally wounded. But this also covers those who've already fallen down dead. So it can mean mortally wounded or slain, depending upon... and the fact that it says will fall would suggest that they are mortally wounded. They haven't fallen yet. They're not actually dead. The cal imperfect of Naphael. N-A-P-H-A-L. They will fall in her midst, inseparable preposition bait plus this noun again, ta-wek. That means with the third feminine singular suffix, in the midst or the middle of it, they're all going to fall right there in the land where I judge them. All right, point one here. Verse 46 continues with God addressing the Jews prior to the fall, which follows his command for them to vacate prophetic Babylon in verse 45. Two, the sentence begins with a wow and the conjunction pen, so that not or lest, which most Hebrew lexicons define as lest. That's the way they will translate it. Now, Dahoud notes that when this conjunction is used at the beginning of a sentence, it is used to dissuade one from a particular course of action. And that's why you see the addition of the word beware here. The word beware is not in the text. But it's an understanding of the way this particular conjunction functions when it comes at the beginning of a sentence. For instance here, Job 32. Job 32, 13. And they just translated here, do not say, but actually what you hear is lest you will say. And the idea is be careful. Beware that you say this. That you say that we have found wisdom. God will rout him, not man. And it's also, say, Isaiah 36, 18. And that comes out of his Hebrew Ugaritic Lexicography, Volume 7, out of the Biblica Journal, Volume 51. There's where that all comes from. So beware, and they've supplied it here, lest Hezekiah does not mislead you. The idea is be cautious. Don't fall for this. And here it's be cautious. Don't let your heart get worried. Don't become worried about all this. God's going to take care of you. Well, people can hardly faith rest their living grace now. How are they going to faith rest uprooting and leaving the nation? That's a big deal. I mean, you can imagine how big of a deal that would be. If you could get people to relocate for doctrine, now we're talking about relocating to say, maybe that's what we ought to advertise. We'll get us a sign put out front, move here or die. You know, we won't. But the fact is, it's difficult to motivate people. And again, the problem, big problem here is almost all these people are going to be negative. A big percentage of them are going to be negative. They're not going to be believers, and they don't care, and they don't believe it. It's just we've heard Christians say this stuff before. They're rabble rousers, huh? I don't think so. Well, B, in that regard, he notes that it is sometimes the stylistic equivalent of the negative adverb al, no or not, and the jussive use of the imperfect. And so, therefore, it may be translated as do not, or as they've translated here, beware, lest your heart fail you, is the idea. Psalm 28, verse 1. A psalm of David. To you, O Lord, I call. My rock, do not be deaf to me. For if you are silent to me, I will become like those who go down to the pit. And the idea here is, in this phrase, if you are silent to me, which is equivalent, essentially, of do not be silent to me. That's what I'm getting at here. And then, I'm sorry, then towards the end of the sentence, lest I have become like those who go down to the pit. There's our pin. So the idea here is, again, I don't want to go down to the pit. So I count on you to make sure that doesn't happen. Well, the theological word book of the Old Testament indicates that the primary function of this conjunction is to express precaution. And the translation lest suggests that. That it's a precautionary term. And thus it seems best to understand this as having a similar or the same force as many prohibitions that are found in the Hebrew Old Testament. And the New American Standard has reflected the fact that if one translates this as lest, it results in an incomplete thought, as witnessed by the dashes in verse 46, if you look in their version. As you can see, what it appears that the sentence has left off. But if you just translate this, as it were, like a finite verb, beware that your heart grows faint, and you understand it as that's what it says. That's a command. And that's a complete thought. Beware that this happens. Look out. And so because they've simply translated it lest here, they didn't put beware in there. They didn't get that it's a prohibition at some level, so they leave an incomplete sentence. Well, God instructs his people, point five, not to lose their resolve. That's the biggest thing you fight with people, is keeping them motivated. They have to be resolved to want to do the right things. Now, that's where the volition comes in. People have to choose to do the right thing. They have to want to. You have to be motivated. If you're not motivated to do the right thing, it's very unlikely that you're going to do it. Even if you are motivated, you're fighting these battles on all these fronts to do the right thing. You fight it on the spiritual front with the demons and all those attacks. You fight it in your own sin nature, which doesn't always say, oh good, I want to sacrifice. I want to make it as hard on me as possible. No, that's not the sin nature. The sin nature generally takes the path of least resistance. That's the sin nature. So the idea here is keeping people's resolve up, keeping their hearts headed in the right direction, not to throw in the towel, not to give up. The verb rakak means to be soft or tender. For instance, it's used in Psalm in that way, and this one's a pretty easy one, Psalm 55, where David talks about it in terms of his youth. Well, I'm taking it back. This is another one. I thought this was going to be another verse, but here. Psalm 55:21. God instructs his people not... the word rakak means to be soft or tender. His speech was smoother than oil. But his heart was war. His words were softer than oil. Yet they were drawn swords. That's our word there, the one translated softer. Smoother might be a better translation there, but that's okay. But we understand what he's saying here in this analogy. It's clearly a synonymous parallelism. His speech was smooth like butter, words like softer than oil. You can also see Isaiah 1:6. But when used with the noun heart, it means to be faint or to lose courage. Deuteronomy 23. Everybody faces fear. Everybody faces worry. There isn't anybody that's immune to this, from the pastor right on down. But it's when you want to throw in the towel, not doing it. That's the bigger issue. That's why we want to strengthen you, build you up, edify you in the inner man. So that when the troublesome things in life come, and they are coming to everybody, everybody's feet are going to be put to the fire. Jesus made this play, and there were two men that built with two different foundations. The wise man built on a solid granite foundation on bedrock. The fool built on the seashore. And when the storms of life came, he says, the fall of that house built out there on the sand was great. But the other house withstood it. But they both faced the same storms, or the same storm, as it were. So the tests of life are going to come. And they're coming to show you what you're made out of. And sometimes, again, when we look into the law of liberty, it isn't all that pretty what we're made out of. But this is a part of seeing this, is so we can deal with it. So we can say, okay, I'm not going to let my heart grow cold. I'm not going to lose courage. Deuteronomy 23, he shall say to them, hear, O Israel, you are approaching the battle against your enemies today. Do not be faint-hearted. Do not be afraid or panic. Or tremble before them. And here, ours, I believe, is the word that's translated faint-hearted. Do not be faint-hearted. And also you can see Job 23:16, similar idea. So this is followed here now by another imperfect of the verb yare, to be afraid or fear. This indicates that the cause of their potential fear and discouragement will be the news that they will be hearing during the time leading up to Babylon's destruction. Well, what kind of news do we hear today? We're bombarded with it. We're on information overload 24/7. And it's not new news. It's the same news regurgitated three times over three different days, but nothing changes. I understand why people look at the weather map. You want to see what's happening. I get all that. I do too. But why bother looking at North Carolina? I can tell you what it is. Don't even have to look. Don't need to see it for 3 days to know it's there happening. And there's nothing I can do about it other than offer up general prayers that God will bless the positive believers there, keep them safe. The rest of them, they're on their own. But that's just the way it is. So as people hear the news, and once they start hearing the news, though, the word comes out, this country is going to be destroyed. This country is going to be wiped off the map. Everybody here is going to die. Well, that's not good news. We could safely say that's not good news. And that's the kind of news that would shake people up. And some people, of course, you know how people reacted. Well, that's not true. They just blow it off. It's inconsequential. Other people, they take it so seriously it scares them to death. And if it scares you to death too much, then you're going to be paralyzed with fear and you won't act. So you want to be not that. That's the whole point here. Don't lose courage and don't be afraid. Seven, the noun shemua, report, has the form of a passive participle and refers to all manner of news that one may hear. It's not always bad news, both good. Say Isaiah 53:1, that's a good example of good news. Real good news, in fact. But the question is, who believes it? Even if the report's correct and accurate, sound, based in doctrine, who believes it? Who hears it?
Who has believed our message? What we have reported is the idea. And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? And then it goes in, and of course this is one of the great messianic psalms, the Song of the Suffering Servant. That Mark, of course, that book, when we studied it, it begins with Jesus as the servant of God and morphs into this suffering servant motif. Towards the end of his life, obviously, we know that's why he came. And also 2 Samuel 13:30, I think that's bad news there, but it can be used of either one. 8, it also is used of reports that may or may not be true. And in those cases, it's translated by the English term rumor. 2 Kings 19:7. Because sometimes people say stuff and they don't know if it's true. They think it might be. But in that case, it is just a rumor. Here, talking about the king of Assyria. And God's going to judge him. Behold, I will put a spirit in him. So that he will hear a rumor and return to his own land. And I will make him fall by the sword in his own land. But here the word is actually a report. Now, is that they've suggested here that this report is not true, that it's a false report that God uses to mislead him to get him back where he wants it. Again, I have to stop and do the book, and I'm not going to, so you'll just have to take that. Daniel, also it's used this way. Daniel 11:44. Sometimes you just have to be smart enough to say, I'm not 100% certain, and I'm not going to fake it. I'm not just going to pound the pulpit and make it so until I am 100% certain. Part of the intellectual honesty of every communicator is to say what you don't know sometimes. And that doesn't make me look good. So what? Are you here to look good or to please God? And it's not about us looking good. It's about us communicating the truth. So that people can have something they know they can trust. That he will give it to you straight. But rumors from the east and the north will disturb him. And he will go forth with great... This is Antichrist here at the very end, by the way. To destroy and annihilate many. Antichrist has a lot on his plate right at the end. I feel for him. No, not really. I don't. But he will have a lot on his plate. Of that, it's tough running the world. And I mean, especially when you got people that don't like you and want to kill you. That's what I'm going to want. Now see, here's the problem. Who's going to rule the world? That's what the final fight's all about. But that goes back to the beginning fight between God and Satan. Who's going to rule planet Earth? And every satanic person out there, every demonic leader over the course of history has had ideas of global domination back as far back as Alexander the Great and no doubt before that. Alexander said, there was the prophecy there, I believe it was the oracle at Siwa that told him, you will eventually rule the entire world. And that was what he set out to do. He fully believed he was a god in some ways. And of course, should he be our man and come back, he'll still believe the same stuff. It won't have slowed him down any, being dead all these years. Well, given the modern news media, point 9, and the amount of time and energy they put into providing information overload, there is little doubt that every political development, whether true or perceived as true, will be broadcast on a daily basis throughout Babylon. It'll be on CNN 24/7. I'm sure they'll be on the news right up until it hits. And they'll still be doling out their version of the truth. All right, well, our time is gone there. We're going to have to stop there for today. We will pick up here on Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to consider these matters. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our spiritual growth, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.